Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
We have a couple of interesting news of the weirds, but first and foremost, we have a guest, our sometime colleague, well, all everyday colleague and sometime partner here in crime on the air, Mira Achilles, is back with us this week. Hi, Mira.
Hello. How's it going?
Pretty good. Give me that voice. Let me that lovely voice again. Let me get your sound level.
Alrighty. Hello. How's it going?
Perfect.
Wonderful.
Let's vocal burr away. Okay. So, evolution in action has just been demonstrated. This was reported in USA Today. However, there is actually a researcher who did the work, whose name is Clément Venoget. They're an associate professor at Virginia Tech, and they are studying mosquitoes. And just like Pavlov's dogs learn to associate dinner time with a bell ringing and then salivate when they just heard the bell, well, guess what mosquitoes have come to associate with dinner time?
Is it a smell?
Yes.
Ooh.
All right. Keep
guessing. Smell of us.
Something about a smell we might apply to ourselves.
Could it be sugar or something with the blood?
It's actually mosquito repellent.
What?
Yes.
Well, that seems counterproductive.
Well, not for the mosquito.
Exactly.
It's like if you smell DEET anywhere in the wild, there are humans there.
That makes
sense. It is not a naturally occurring smell. And the mosquitoes, these are researchers both in France and Virginia. They trained a group of yellow fever mosquitoes by giving them a meal of warm blood while exposing them to the chemical smell. After four such pairings, more than 60% of the trained insects lunged at the smell of DEET alone. Didn't even need any blood in sight. Given a choice between a bare hand and one slathered in DEET at normal strength, untrained mosquitoes steered clear of the chemical, but the trained mosquitoes were right to it. So, this proves the mosquito's brain can rewrite that response based on experience. What the mosquito has learned matters just as much as what the chemical does. Mosquitoes kill as many as a million people a year. I know, a million, huh?
Wow.
And that's with spreading dengue, Zika virus, malaria. And DEET is one of the most effective protections available. But the lesson is, use enough, because you need that concentration to stay very high. If the mosquitoes start getting through your lightly applied DEET, that mosquito might learn a life lesson that we'll come to regret.
Exactly. Wow. Slather up.
Exactly. And my other news of the weird to just kick us off today is the compass in a pigeon. Now, homing pigeons tap into the Earth's magnetic field. We all know that, right? We just haven't figured out how they do it. It's long stumped scientists exactly where these magnetic crystals that we postulate are in the brain, in the ear. That seems logical. But now a new controversial new theory points somewhere unexpected. You could call it flying by the seat of the pants. It's actually flying a little bit north of the seat of the pants. It's the liver.
Wow.
It turns out that the liver is full of iron-rich cells. Duh, right? It processes all the blood. And these iron-rich cells are macrophages, so they're amoebas. And they chomp up all of the iron out of the broken-down blood that the liver's taking care of to recycle. And they may be working as a compass needle and telling the pigeon, you know, literally, I have a gut feeling we should go that way.
Wow.
And so to prove this, or at least to provide evidence, researchers in Germany gave pigeons a drug that wiped out their macrophages in their liver and released the birds on a cloudy day. The animals became completely disoriented. They were completely lost. The lead author, Clivia Lisowski, from the University of Bonn, told Scientific American, it was crazy. They were going in all directions. Critics remain unconvinced, saying that trace iron in the macrophages is too weakly magnetic to respond to the Earth's faint field, and the birds might simply have been agitated by the drug that killed the macrophages. Well, both are possible. Right now, it's just speculation, but I do hope the liver-laden macrophages turn out to be the secret to pigeon navigation. I think that would be just perfect.
Absolutely.
And if you come across a news of the weird, feel free to send it to us here at Ask Dr. Dawn. You can send it to the station, or you can go to AskDrDawn.com and click the Contact Us and drop a link in there of your news of the weird. They have to be at least a little bit sciency, preferably some biology involved, at least remotely, beyond the hands of the researchers doing the work. But it could be computer modeling. Some of those have been pretty weird lately. Now, Mira, Mira is also works with me, and she is a fabulous assistant at my medical practice. And one of her jobs is to print out articles that I use for the show. And this one you reacted to quite a lot. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the article?
I mean, from a first impression, so we have researchers accidentally discover that humans prefer to turn counterclockwise, but they still have no idea why. And so when I first saw this title, I immediately looked at my left and right hand and thought, well, that can't be right because I'm right-handed. So naturally, I would go to my dominant side. But in fact, when I closed my eyes and thought about a turn, I did in fact want to go counterclockwise. So it just struck me that maybe that doesn't have so much to do with dominance as I would have thought.
Yeah, it's interesting because in this study, they looked at right-handedness versus left-handedness. Ah. And it's everybody, right-handed
wow.
or left-handed, they all want to turn left. But in studies looking at animals, they don't find this sort of left-handed clockwise bias. The way they were doing this is it was during COVID, and they were studying how crowds moved in space and social distancing behaviors. And they wanted to see how many people could easily walk in an enclosed space while still being apart. So they looked at their video footage, and that's when they realized that people were moving counterclockwise. In 32 out of 33 trials, as people moved and turned to stay with that 6 feet space, they noticeably preferred to turn counterclockwise. And you'd think that wouldn't be the case. Then they tested different groups of walkers in different sizes, different locations, and both in different cultures, Spain and Japan. So just to make sure, here's a little tidbit. If there's a narrow walkway and you're passing a man, the man will turn his body towards the person he's passing. The woman will turn her shoulder away from the person she's passing.
Oh.
And that's also pretty unconscious. We'll pick up this call. And, caller, I've got you on here. Turn off your radio. I'll be picking up your call in just a moment. We're just going to finish off with this phenomenon of people always wanting to turn to the left. Animals don't have any directional preference. And it's really strange. It suggests a biochemical asymmetry, but what would this be? I was postulating maybe it was our language centers being so overdeveloped. Because our language centers are really near our inner ear, and because for most people, most people have a large left temporal lobe, that's where your language center is. I'm wondering if maybe that creates some sort of little bias. I don't know how you would do that. But you know what? We've built this society this way. If you look at racetracks, they are all counterclockwise. Even ones that are run by horses. It doesn't even have to be people.
Oh,
but
wow.
most of the track and field competitions run counterclockwise.
Wow.
So a new thing to observe, kind of a medical mystery. But, I love... Did you ever notice? And it's like, no, I didn't. But now I will.
Exactly.
Now I will.
Exactly.
All right. Well, let's go to our first caller. Hello. You're on the air. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hello, this is Mardine from Ben Lomond.
Hi, Mardine. How are you up there in Ben Lomond? Did it get real hot today?
Pretty good.
Did you get, was it a nice day or did it get steaming again?
It's kind of cloudy and chilly, which is nice.
A change.
Being way too hot.
Yeah, a nice break. Well, what is your question today, Mardine?
I actually have a couple of questions.
We can handle
first
that.
First is about fluoride-free toothpaste.
Okay.
Nanohydroxyapatite.
Mm-hmm.
I tried using FIGG, F-Y-G-G, for your Good Guys toothpaste, which is nanohydroxyapatite. You know, that's one of the ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to notice very quickly that the inside of my mouth became very sensitive, almost painful. All of the mucous membranes were sort of irritated and felt inflamed. So my gums, my tongue, you know, everything in my mouth was really irritated. And I stopped using it, and that went away after a few days. And I just wonder, you know, if anybody else has found that to be a problem, if there's something in the nanohydroxyapatite that is irritating to some people.
Well, I suspect that it's probably a bystander component that's in there. It could be a flavoring. I know these are supposed to be like super clean, but they've got stuff in them. They have to make a paste. They add things to get a certain consistency to make sure that it doesn't dry out and get all cakey. So there's a fair amount of chemistry in any toothpaste.
Sure.
The cleanest toothpaste, of course, is baking soda.
Right.
And, you know, and that will, you know, be a little too abrasive for most of us, so we go with something cleaner. The purpose of the microhydroxyapatite is remineralization, because as we chew and bite on things, we get tiny little cracks in our teeth, and that leads to temperature sensitivity, cold, heat and cold sensitivity. And so these remineralizing things are so small, little tiny particles, essentially. They act like grout and get in there and block up the passageways that are allowing the hot or the cold liquid to get close to the nerve. So I think it would be something else. And it could be I don't know how the flavor was, but there's a clove or a mint flavor in these things, at least faintly.
Yeah.
So I would say flavoring would be my top thing. The only way you would know for sure would be to re-challenge yourself with the same toothpaste, because it is possible that you ate something else that irritated your mouth, and it just happened to be coincidentally at the same time you started this toothpaste. So you always have to think of the innocent bystander possibility, but you make a good case for it being that particular toothpaste. What was your goal in choosing that toothpaste?
I had heard podcast episodes interviewing functional dentists who had, you know, said that fluoride-free toothpastes are better for your microbiome. And,
definitely. Better for your microbiome. There's a lot of fluoride-free toothpastes out there. And, you know, I would go with a different brand that didn't have the microhydroxyapatite, by a small tube and just use it. And the Tom's company has a lot of good products that I've generally heard in 30 years nobody's, I think, ever reported a reaction to them, but that's not, you know, a huge in. There's always the possibility of an allergic reaction. We don't really want you using more of that toothpaste.
So. Yeah. I did try it again, you know, just to test it, same thing happened.
Yeah, all right. So you did the second challenge, so we know it's that.
Yeah.
How scientific of you.
I try.
Okay. Well, what other questions do you have?
The other question has to do with turmeric. My sister brought up something that she had heard about people basically overdosing on turmeric and having liver
Liver toxicity. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I looked it up on, I don't know, PubMed or, you know, one of the websites, and there was a study that had been done saying that, yes, it is possible to, you know, overdose on it, use too much of it, and have a liver toxicity. Mm-hmm. But then I heard also that, you know, the unregulated nature of supplements means that sometimes what it says that the dosage of turmeric is in a capsule is actually more than what, you know, what it says on the bottle.
As a general statement about the market, that's true. As a specific statement about the more ethical companies that one like myself patronizes, that's not very true, because they have what are called good manufacturing practices. So they do measure things as carefully as a compounding pharmacist would. And so you're within a 5 or 10% margin on the batch. And that's not enough to get into overdose territory. For that, you're going to need like 10 times more.
Okay.
And there's also with stuff, so the imported stuff needs to be checked as it comes through the door, and the good companies do that. They get these big sacks of, you name it, or, you know, barrels of stuff, and they run it through a mass spectrometer, and they make sure that it doesn't have lead and doesn't have mercury and has what it says it does at the amount that it should. And those are all things that are part of being a diligent manufacturer. And so mm-hmm. there is some cost for that, but it isn't necessarily true that the most expensive products are the best. Mm-hmm. There are very good products. I would mention Now, N-O-W, as one of the less expensive brands that still does this good due diligence on their products.
Okay. I'm familiar with that one.
Yeah, they've got this nice bright orange label. It's kind of hard to miss.
What I've been doing is making myself a drink that's like a golden tea or, you know, golden milk with the turmeric. And I put a few other things in it, like chia seeds and ginger and cinnamon, so it's, you know, sort of a immune support.
Yeah, well, basically, turmeric has a compound in it called curcumin, mm-hmm. and it's fairly abundant in the root, but it's poorly absorbed. So, if a person's starting out with powdered turmeric that they didn't make, it could be stale, so it may have lost some of its potency. If you buy the roots at the farmer's market and grate them, you're going to get, you know, the still moist, very, very good stuff. But that's not going to mix into a milk. So usually people are buying a powdered turmeric. And the absorption of the curcumin, which is the asp or curcuminoids, because there's several of them, that's the real strong anti-inflammatory stuff. That's the one that goes after that complex called NF-kappa B, which is a whole host of pain-producing chemicals that are part of a group that get turned on by this. It's like the go button on the DNA is this NF-kappa B. So when you bind to it, it sets off this chain reaction and generates a whole bunch of messenger RNA, and you make a whole bunch of prostaglandins and bradykinins and other inflammatory molecules, which is great if you have an infection and need to fight something. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that's really great. But it's not so great if you've got ongoing chronic infection, and so turning off that NF-kappa B once it's been triggered and sort of left running is what the curcumin does. So you want to be able to absorb it. Little pepper is good. Certainly if you're using roots, you're going to need to put in about 10% black pepper, fresh ground.
I do add black pepper as well.
Yeah, if you're using this for antioxidant and if you're using this for antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, your dose is about 5 grams a day of turmeric. So that's roughly a teaspoon, 5 grams.
That's about what I've done, yeah. I put a teaspoon and like an eighth of a teaspoon of pepper.
Perfect.
And all the other ingredients, you know, and I just drink that every day.
Mardine, I think you've been listening to this show because you're using my recipe.
You can tell.
Yeah, it's all right. It's free. It's free. It's public domain. I didn't pay for it either. Okay. So any other question?
If I'm buying, you know, from the spice rack, just the powdered turmeric and using that, I guess what you're saying is that there's no guarantee that it's really as, powerful as it might
you,
be.
You might have lost potency. It's tricky to figure out what to do about that because, of course, bulk things sit. So I recommend buying small containers that, I guess there's two ways to look about it. If you talk to the people at the health food store, you know, they have that big bin of turmeric. So ask them how often they refresh it, you know, how often do they replace it? Because once it gets in there, it's not in contact with very much air, very much stuff, so it's probably pretty good. So if it's not sitting there for, you know, 3 months, if they're turning over monthly, I think you're fine.
Yeah, I'm buying, you know, literally the little container from the spice rack, like McCormick's, you know?
Just use your tongue. I mean, train your tongue to compare how pungent it is.
Huh.
And smell, you know.
If
it's stale, it won't smell as strongly and it won't have that zing on your tongue.
Yeah, it definitely has the zing. I can feel it, you know. Okay. I can taste it when I'm drinking it.
Yeah.
And it sounds like there's very little chance that I'm going to overdose.
There's no chance you're not going to overdose. You'd have to I think you could probably eat a bowl of turmeric root and still stay below the toxic level.
Okay, good. That's what I was hoping you would say.
All right.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Keep listening.
I will.
So let's go to our first email.
We've got Miss Susan in Bonnie Doon, and the question today is, a friend of mine underwent surgery and 10 chemotherapy infusions for colon cancer. Nearly 3 months after their last infusion, they're still extremely tired, has a low red blood cell count, and low hemoglobin. They're taking supplemental iron, but the main complaint is neuropathy of the hands. They have an oncologist that's really said nothing about what to do after the chemotherapy. What would you suggest that might relieve this neuropathy? Would acupuncture help, for example?
Actually, acupuncture is something I've used a lot of times in people who get the neuropathy in their hands or feet from chemo. And it works more than half the time. And
wow.
I don't know dose what I don't know what the connection is, but essentially it's a fairly straightforward. It involves putting a couple of needles in, and I should say that Mira helps me sometimes in the acupuncture suite. So we put a couple of needles on one side of the hand, a couple on the other side, and they are connected to linked meridians, and so it's like we're doing. It's like we're recirculating the chi energy that's being driven by a little bit of electrical stimulation, and we're running it in a circle back and forth. So like we're erasing debris, we're bringing blood flow in, we're changing the settings, we hope, on the nerves. And for the way I know I've done it long enough treatment is that the neuropathy goes away temporarily or the sensation changes. I live in a place where there's two highways that connect. It's a T intersection. It's way out in the boonies. And every so often in the middle of the night, I can hear some guy doing tight circles and screaming wheels and just doing loops at that intersection. And I don't know if it's like more than one person, but it definitely happens frequently. And when I think about the recirculation, what we're doing is we're speeding up the flow of chi, and then we're looping it back through itself. And it, you can kind of see how that would sort of have a cleaning action or a washing action. If you're going to, if you're using a hose to clean something off, you'll often run your, move your hand back and forth and kind of whip it around to get something going. And I think maybe that's what we're doing, is clearing the channels. I like, because I'm sending blood in there, I like to do it with a high dose of methylated B12 and methylated folate. And I'm going to give the doses, people, so go get your pencil. Alpha-lipoic acid and acetyl-L-carnitine. And all of these are standard functional medicine treatments for neuropathy and also for tinnitus. We will use it as well. There's data, there's a study where they used alpha-lipoic acid in people who were subjected to an industrial noise. I think it was an explosion, and their employees all had tinnitus, and so it was perfect living experiment. So they just gave them 300 milligrams twice a day, and some of them took it, and some of them were in the control group. And the there was about a 50% reduction in the tinnitus, which is a type of neuropathy of the ear, in the treated group. So that was, there's some, you know, placebo-controlled evidence. So back to doses. The methyl B12 is 2,000 micrograms a day. And by the way, these are maximum doses. It should be 1,000 twice a day. The methylated folic acid is the same. It's 1,000 micrograms twice a day. The alpha-lipoic acid is 300 milligrams twice a day. And the acetyl-L-carnitine is 1,500 milligrams a day. And this is me giving my opinion, telling you how I treat my patients with this problem. I did some research to look if I was missing anything, and I'm not surprised to see that photomodulation floated to the top. Now, this is this relatively new thing that is really exploding in alternative medicine circles and also in aesthetic circles. So dermatologists and aestheticians, cosmetologists are all over this because it doesn't require a prescription. Oh. And it's near infrared light. It's about 635 nanograms. So it's red light, but there's a fair amount of infrared included in it. And so it's a loose, soft laser light. It's very coherent, and that's important. And the studies show it increases blood flow, increases collagen deposition in wounds and damaged tissue. And so we can measure the collagen because we can stain for it, but it's probably doing other things as well that we don't have the technology necessarily, you know, without chopping out a bit of skin and looking at it under a microscope to say what else is being improved. But photomodulation has definitely come unto its own. So you can buy a little dome that you would put your hand under. There's probably even gloves. Prices are running in the couple hundreds for these photomodulation devices, and I think they work. Those of you that saw the movie One Battle After Another might remember at the beginning the lady who's like the corporate boss of the company is wearing a white mask on her face and it's glowing red. That's a photomodulation mask. It's exactly what I'm talking about.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, do you think this protocol could potentially work for diabetic neuropathy?
Yes.
There
are studies going on as we speak. And the trouble with something, well, trouble with pain in general, it's hard to measure.
Absolutely.
So if you get so it's all very subjective. You know, you have that one to five or that one to 10 scale and you make a mark. And we know just from pain studies where we give people like the same amount of pain, but if they're hungry or if they have a stomach ache or if they are sad, if they're afraid, they're going to put that mark in a different place because our emotions have a serious impact on how we perceive physical pain.
Hmm. That makes sense.
It,
absolutely.
It does indeed. This is one of the reasons why, it's very clear that if you're afraid of what a pain means, I've had this myself, oh my God, is this cancer? Is this why I'm waking up in the middle of the night with pain? That's what people with cancer do. You know, they wake up in the middle of the night because they have spinal mets, and this is the doctor, you know, mentality just making you crazy, which it does. And, you know, it's like as soon as it's, no, it's just gastritis. It didn't hurt half as much.
Exactly.
It just was like, oh, I can deal with gastritis. There's used to be an ad of this person sitting in the emergency room, and they're wearing a gown, and they first they look really, you know, angry and anxious and scared, and then the doctor comes in, and their face just blossoms into a smile, and then you have the voice, and the doctor said, "My Lanta."
Exactly.
It's heartburn, not a heart attack.
Absolutely.
Take some My Lanta. Have a nice evening. Thank you, doctor.
You saved me.
Yes, exactly. That's the kind of save we like. It's low, you know, it's the things that these new technologies and, as far as that goes, new medical therapies offer us are so bright and shiny that it's mm-hmm. it's hard to resist. I mean, we're seeing that with AI now, the sort of headlong charge that, of course, definitely reproduces some of the stuff we saw during the Industrial Revolution in the late 19th century. And so you've got to wonder, what are we going to find out? And, you know, plastic, the last 50 years has been the age of plastic, and now it's like, oops, wait, it's getting into the food chain. I'm not sure that's a good idea either. But yet, there's all of this benefit that comes from these materials. So it's always a Faustian bargain, I guess. I agree with you that we're having an experiment. I kind of go with the fact that humans are very, very adaptable critters, and genetics and epigenetics are extremely adaptable. There are these, I think it's in Chernobyl, I read something about these black butterflies or black moths that they've just kicked up their melanin. This is an epigenetic change, but the melanin keeps the radiation from killing them. So by turning themselves black, it's like they have a coat of sunscreen or radiation screen on their bodies. And so and that happened in 30 years. I think Chernobyl was 30 years ago. I'm trying to remember. Jimmy Carter was president during Chernobyl.
Right? Yeah.
So it would have been in the mid to late 70s. So, yeah. So, you know, 50 years. But nevertheless, and there are humans who have been living in that radiation field and didn't die any sooner than you would have really expected them to. I think that if I'm remembering correctly, there are people who we know to be more radiation resistant. And there's a lot, this came out of the space program and some earlier work from Japan after Hiroshima. And so there's an attempt to figure out how we can take those genes for radiation resistance and deliberately upregulate them, and maybe using messenger RNA injections or something so that people make more of that radiation resistance products before we send, you know, shoot, among other things, shoot them off into space to live on a space station on a planetary body with no magnetic field, and therefore lots of radiation coming in.
Yeah. So. And that goes right to one of my thoughts when I was originally going to call you was, we are primates, monkeys, chimpanzees, us, gorillas. Bonobos.
Oh, let's not forget the bonobos. They're my favorite.
Yeah. And I wonder what the adaptive genetic change came about to give us hair that grows out of our head and basically unlimited length of growth versus gorillas or bonobos or chimpanzees. Their hair doesn't grow on top of their head except to a certain point. And then we have that different type of hair on our eyebrows, and it grows to a certain point, and some people maybe a little bit longer. And now that I'm older, I have hair that grows out of my ears.
Mm-hmm. and your nose, let's be honest, they're there too.
And we have the different kind of hair in the underarm versus the pubic area. I wonder the genetic basis for our adaptation into what we have evolved into having versus those other primates. And did it benefit us in some way, or did it not make any difference?
Well, some of it's sexual selection. And I think that benefited us. But I can't, that's just a guess, but I think it's a pretty good guess given armpits and crotch retaining their hair. Just sounds to me like pheromones and particular smells are useful from a sexual selection standpoint.
Yeah, and why do men, mostly men, have facial hair where mostly females do not?
The hypothesis I've heard the most is neoteny. So by not having facial hair, women resemble infants and children more, and extra facial fat, more rounded bodies. And, you know, that serves a biological purpose, but it's also a don't kill me signal. And so baby animals, for example, any baby animal, I mean, you know, even baby spiders are cute. They have big eyes. They have bigger, you know, bigger eye to body ratio. And you can, there is just something about the big eyes, little mouth that's hardwired into our brain. And I wonder if that isn't at least part of it, is that it's attractive and it gets, it invokes certain nurturing friend type emotions in the male brain. And so it shapes us. And think about dogs and those big brown eyes. Or even their blue ones, you know, those big eyes and the way they look at you, it's just like a way a baby looks at you.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, I appreciate your opinion on diverse.
Well, it's been fun, John. Thank you for the call.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye. Oh, earlier on in the show, I actually had Mira go out and do what she did last time. And so let's do question number 8. These are questions crowdsourced from Mira's companions and friends. And so go ahead and read question 8, and then I will give you my answer.
Alrighty. So, you know, we're here in Santa Cruz, and my friend was wondering what's going on with the water in Santa Cruz County, and why does it make people weird? I just love that word, weird.
Well, we even have bumper stickers, you know, keep Santa Cruz weird. But I don't think it's as much the water as the setting.
Ah.
Now, Santa Cruz has a really permissive atmosphere with low penalties for aberrant behavior. There's not a high loss of benefit by non-conforming.
Ah.
So, there are plenty of places where if you behaved that way, you know, everyone would turn and look at you, and they'd give you that "don't do that church," you know, "don't do that in church on Sunday" look, or you know, you would be otherwise penalized by a different kind of expression and regard from others. Whereas here, it's mostly a laugh or a shrug, if that. There's low penalties for aberrant behavior as long as it's peaceful, and a sense here, I think, that traditional norms of behavior in dress, in sexuality, can be discarded, a kind of social freedom that maybe lets people take things a little further than they should for their own reasons. But not being othered by your behavior, I think, is a big piece of what this area is about. And also, talking about mirroring, I think we have a mirror echoing phenomenon that I've been observing. So when you're in a room with somebody, if you like them or you're attracted to them, you'll find yourself imitating their posture. And it's how humans build rapport. Psychologists do it all the time if they want to build rapport. Police negotiators do it, mimic the tone of voice, the cadence, the pacing, the word choice, and the posture. And this creates a feeling of togetherness and that things are right and safe. And I think in Santa Cruz, what's happened with the outrageous behavior is that it's inverted into many small subgroups that share that and that mirror and share that behavior internally. And so it is conformist behavior, but it's conformist behavior within a small cohort. But you still get the reinforcement for the behavior that I think that helps it perpetuate.
Absolutely.
So it's kind of a two-level phenomenon.
I wonder if some of this weirdness is a leftover from the 60s and that whole era.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And when I came, I was a little girl in the 60s, and I have always regretted that I didn't get to play with the big kids. So that was one of the reasons I moved here. But to a naive viewer who comes here with an expectation of conventional norms, they see it as very discordant and chaotic. Hmm. And yet it isn't. It's fine. But it does look weird, I think, to the outside eye, but if you're not prepared for it.
Absolutely.
All right, well, we have time for just one more question. It looks like, why don't we do, I'll just read this one. So this is actually, we're collapsing too. We'll come back and do these questions again. I'll come back and do them next week because I'm always interested in what people want to know. And by these open-ended questions are in a way, but just by reading them, you could tell they're shaped by the internet and by memes and by things people have seen on YouTube or in Instagram or whatever. So how important are B vitamins for women in their mid-20s? And what vitamin stack would the doctor recommend for a woman in their mid-20s? And the first answer to that question is it really depends on diet.
Mm.
And so if a person is actually eating a healthy diet with lots of actually fresh or reasonably fresh fruits and vegetables, things that haven't been overprocessed, they're probably going to do just fine. But if they are eating lots of fast food or overprocessed food where a lot of the vitamins have been leached out of it, or they're eating out a lot, I would say yes. And since we're talking about women in their mid-20s, I would say prenatal vitamins. Because those are going to have levels of the B vitamins, and they're going to have a little extra iron, which women in their 20s need because they're menstruating. But the most important thing is it really depends on diet. So if it really depends on diet, how much you need. If you are eating the standard American diet or you're eating in the dorms, you haven't got much control, a B100 complex, 500 milligrams of calcium with some acid, so with some vitamin C. And we had a call that came through. We're going to go ahead and pick that up. We don't have a lot of time, but if you want to ask your question quickly, we can probably get to it. Are you there?
Yes, just briefly, Eileen, active listener. Love your show.
Thanks, Eileen.
Dear doctor. And I was surprised and delighted. I do some volunteer activity work occasionally for Western Service workers, and that you're one of the sponsors.
Yes. Well, I volunteer there. I run a free clinic for the farm workers, the people who are off the grid.
Indeed.
And we try to, some of the residents at the new family medicine residency at Dominican have actually come by and helped out, given some nutrition education. And
that's great.
So it's been good. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.